Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today we are diving back again into Everyday Stalinism by Sheila Fitzpatrick. We're coming to the last part of the book where she looks at the experience of everyday life under the great Stalinist terrors of the 1930s. And to begin with, Sheila Fitzpatrick makes a key distinction between surveillance states and terror states, the former being generally more prevalent than the latter. She writes, "Surveillance means the population is watched. Terror means that its members are subject to an unpredictable but large-scale basis to arrest, execution and other forms of state violence. A society under surveillance does not have to be a society under terror. For example, the German Democratic Republic of the 70s and the 80s was relatively free of terror, although it was watched over by the Stasi, that overachieving pupil of the NKVD, with a thoroughness unparalleled in the history of state security. But there is an obvious relationship between surveillance and terror. The same institutions that are used and many of the same processes are involved. In the Soviet Union, where waves of terror against different groups were of the population started with the Civil War and occurred periodically thereafter throughout the pre-war period, the relationship was particularly close. Surveillance was an everyday reminder of the possibility of terror." There are numerous accounts of an obsessional fear about being coming under surveillance, because really of the extreme consequences that would entail. When somebody had been denounced, everybody surrounding them was desperate to distance themselves, to be as far away from that individual as possible, to have no contact with them, and not to be associated with them, and try to kind of erase as much as possible any connection with them, because they knew that it was entirely possible that they had been watched, information had been passed about them, that the person themselves in interrogation had denounced their neighbours, their friends, their associates, and anybody else that they knew. And so so widespread were the denunciations, and so widespread did they reach, that it creates a general sense of permanent anxiety in society that somebody somewhere may have said something about you. So the instruments of the state that are used to conduct organised surveillance and terror, helped in popular kind of thought to create a kind of a distinction between the individual and the state, or society at large, and the state. The state was them, and society was us. And this was obviously kind of contrary to most of the kind of the intentions and the objectives of the regime. The idea of in the kind of the sanctity of individual space and thought was, you know, a kind of an anathema to the regime, but also the idea of a society that was independent of the state, or that saw itself as independent of the state, or that was organised a kind of in opposition to the state, or organised self-organising in a kind of in contrast to the state. These were definitely not Soviet goals, but this is what ultimately state security and terror achieves. It is very important, writes Sheila Fitzpatrick, for us to understand that this was how Soviet citizens perceived these processes as them and us. But it's also important to realise that this analysis in many ways is unsatisfactory. In a society with almost a million office holders, ranging from powerful figures to petty, poverty-stricken officials out in the countryside, where does the boundary line between them and us lie? Moreover, if they are the people who have their access to state power through office holding, how can a terror like the Great Purges, in which office holders were primary victims, be understood in them and in them against us terms? So this was one of the kind of the experiences of totalitarian regimes in the 20th century, that the boundary line between the regime and the individual is infinitely blurred. That the regime, like it talks here about a million office holders, 1% of the population or thereabouts, becomes diffuse throughout society. Also, the extent to which societies collaborate in the terror against them, have been through denunciations, through informants, and various other ways that individuals can work collaboratively with a repressive state. It clouds these lines, much to the benefit of the machinery of state repression. For a society, the experience of terror is more complicated than simply just the victims themselves and their suffering and the families and the fear of other people in the population, that they might become victims. So the broader societal experience of terror involves victimizing. So it involves the individual choosing to victimize others, be they wearing a uniform or if they are seeing themselves as mentally and emotionally allied to the state, and thus engaging in a process of denunciation. There was a fascinating episode many, many years ago now, about 20 years ago, of the Nazis, A Warning from History, which was a Lawrence Rees documentary with closely collaborating with Ian Kershaw. And at the end, in one of the episodes, they interviewed a quite elderly lady at the time about how she had denounced a neighbour who had been living a kind of what seemed to be an unconventionally German lifestyle. I think the subtext was that the neighbour might have been gay. This was a woman who had female friends coming around to stay, and nobody knew anything about this woman. And so they denounced her, and of course the Gestapo take this person into protective custody. They think there's something kind of un-German about her. She's not behaving in the way that a good German should. And she was disappeared into various camps and died sometime during the war. Now, the woman in question, this is at the end of her life, many years later, said things like, well, you know, we were only doing what we thought was proper at the time. And we, the woman revealed she hadn't really been prompted to do any of these things. That there hadn't been like a message from the government saying, can be a good informant. She had volunteered this information because she was keeping vigilant for the Führer. She was doing her bit. And it's that kind of degree of participatory stuff that a culture of denunciation that creates a culture of denunciation, of people listening to what it is they think that the state or the charismatic leader is saying, and then interpreting that will in ways that they think is appropriate. And so totalitarian states, be they Soviet or Nazi or Maoist or whatever, have an enormous power to corrupt others and to corrupt kind of the basic functionings of human morality without even really having to do much of the asking. So Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "This is also true of the individual experience of terror. Even people who never voluntarily denounced their fellow citizens in the Great Purges failed to defend friends who were publicly pilloried, cut off contact with families of enemies of the people, and in a host of ways found themselves becoming participants in the process of terror. One of the most useful functions of them and us, of the them and us framework for Soviet citizens, and a major reason why historians should approach it warily, was it obscured this unbearable fact. It becomes very easy, long after the terror has ended, to point at the evil state, but much, much harder to admit one's own participation in it. And so, if you are looking at things from a social history point of view, looking at the actions of people, looking at how society functioned at the time, is as useful, if not slightly more so, than trying to understand what it is the state does. It's quite easy to understand that bit. The second bit, not so much. There were obviously many waves of terror, each of them affected different victim groups in different ways. And left many in the prisons and the gulags and others with far more grisly fates. So at the end of the 1920s and the beginning of the 1930s, it was of course the war against the kulaks, the NEP men, the privateers or profiteers who'd made money from the new economic policy, priests, and to some degree the bourgeois specialists. The most famous trial at the end of the 1920s was the Schacht trial, where engineers were put on trial from the region of Schacht, which is a kind of famous coal mining region, and they were accused of sabotage. The Soviet Union had to constantly reinvent this kind of persecution narrative that anything that was going wrong was really the result of external sabotage. It was external powers, anti-Soviet powers, and internal wreckers. And many of the bourgeois specialists, the members of the middle classes who were engineers and agronomists and things like that from the previous regime, that had to be in some way dealt with, and as Stalin saw it, these were kind of enemy class elements who had made a temporary truce with the revolution, but were unlikely to maintain that. And so at the end of the 1920s, just at the time when Stalin really needs to be using these people effectively to industrialise Russia, instead he's waging a kind of a war against them. So, in 1935, following the murder of Kirov, the party boss of Leningrad, the old privileged classes of the party and the former oppositionists in the party and the Komsomol were the next wave of class enemies to be got rid of. Following that comes the Great Terror, the Great Purges.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Which focus on the communist elite, but they kind of spill out into wider society. Denunciation and the belief in connections and conspiracies cause the terror to kind of spread far beyond the immediate party. So here we're going to try to look for the most part at the Great Terror of 1937-38, which was, you know, the fundamental terror episode of the Stalinist era, but obviously, as I said, not the only one. And it was a historical epoch, a historical moment. But the Great Terror is also slightly different. Previously, when the NEP men and the kulaks and the priests and the former people and all this kind of stuff, when they're targeted, they were referred to as class enemies. So that meant if you're not in that class, you're probably going to be all right. Though during the Great Terror, the concept of enemies of the regime expands, and instead we just wind up with enemies. So the terror could be far more widespread, far more indiscriminate. The idea that those that did not belong to these categories, this idea that those that didn't belong to these categories were free from the risk of terror, that seems to kind of evaporate in 1937-38. It's probably unlikely that many Soviet citizens had a great deal of faith in the previous system of terror, that they could be kind of exempted if they weren't kulaks. Nobody had that degree of faith in the regime in terms of its kind of organisation or its vindictiveness. So Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "The Great Purge has introduced a new definition of the target of terror, enemies of the people. In one sense, this was simply a code term indicating that in this terror, in contrast to previous ones, the hunt for enemies should focus particularly on the communist elite. But in another sense, it marked a destruction of the previous conceptual boundaries of terror. Enemies no longer had any specific attributes like class. Anyone could turn out to be an enemy. Soviet terror was random." There were two distinct ways, broadly, that the terror was understood in Russia. A targeted, detailed, structural understanding of the terror, and a more broader, more fatalistic notion of what the terror was. There were, for those who were members of the party who were most at risk of the terror, the idea that the terror was some kind of giant accident or a misfortune was a kind of an anathema to their thinking. There was because it was so destructive, so largely pointless, that there was a desire to find some kind of reason in it, some kind of idea of who was benefiting, belief that that Stalin himself was enacting this dreadful plan. I'm sure, of course, he is, for his own discernible gain. Though often it's hard to see quite what Stalin got out of the terror himself. There is, across the majority of the population, there was a deep fatalism, a sense that the terror was one of these great misfortunes like war or famine or pestilence that sometimes have to be endured. The idea that there's a reason for these misfortunes doesn't really kind of enter the conversation. It is just sort of one of those unfortunate things. And this is probably more prevalent in Russian public thinking than the view that it was a kind of a scheme of Stalin himself, which actually, of course, it is. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "Moreover, what happened in 1937 to 38 affected the lower classes of the population, excluding outcasts and marginals, much more than the elites. For peasants, there was no comparison with the great trauma of the decade, collectivisation. For urban workers, the hunger at the beginning of the decade and the punitive tightening of labour discipline at the end of it loomed larger on the scale of misfortune." By the beginning of 1937, both educated and uneducated Russians were seeing signs that a time of national misfortune was at hand. Both the most important proximate cause for this perception was the failure of the 1936 harvest, which in the following winter and spring led to hunger in the countryside, bread lines in the towns, and a panicky fear that things would get still worse, as in 1932-33. In the countryside, rumours of imminent famine, turmoil and war flew around, as they had done during collectivisation. So there were, of course, other contributing factors. Since the start of the first five-year plan and collectivisation, the regime and society had been under constant and extreme stresses. The five-year plans themselves had led to immense poverty and overcrowding and shortages in towns and cities, and of course, collectivisation in the countryside is sort of verging on a second Soviet civil war, second Russian civil war. There are mounting fears about the international situation, what is happening beyond Germany's borders, Russia's borders, particularly with Nazi Germany, are deeply alarming. After the murder of Kirov, former oppositionists become targets of terror. Zinoviev and Kamenev were tried twice, and in 1936 they are executed for responsibility with the assassination of Kirov, which of course they weren't involved at all. So it's worth remembering when one becomes kind of emotional for certain victims of the terror, that one of Zinoviev's early pronouncements was that if the Soviet regime had to kill 10 million Russians, then probably that would be the right thing to do. So none of the, or very few of those who were members of the regime were particularly angelic figures in themselves, not to suggest that being falsely accused of a crime and then shot is a kind of somehow justified. As the party continued to purge itself of undesirable members, writes Sheila Fitzpatrick, the process became more and more vicious, no longer just a matter of expulsion, but often of arrest. Almost 9% of those expelled in the most recent party purge, a total of more than 15,000, had been arrested as spies, kulaks, white guards, and scoundrels of various kinds. Yezhov told the Central Committee in December 1935. "And there would have to be more arrests," he added. As one speaker at this meeting put it, "as soon as those expelled from the party get home, they start getting involved in counter-revolutionary activity. They should be smoked out before the real trouble occurs. And there you have one of the most compelling explanations for the terror, in that you have a revolutionary society based on the endless fear that the revolution will be overturned, or that external elements will conspire with internal troublemakers to destroy the revolution. And that requires everybody to show a never kind of ceasing level of revolutionary purity. And the way that you do that is by utter loyalty and sycophancy towards Stalin. And even that might not save you, because you just need to be named by the wrong person, being associated with the wrong kind of person, and then you're in big trouble. And the Marxist-Leninist view of history, that inevitably there would be attempts to overthrow the revolution from capitalist societies, and the Russian Civil War gives plenty of evidence of that, means that the state has to be constantly suspicious. It has to be a constant surveillance state, as we mentioned at the start of the podcast. But also, as the international situation deteriorates and war comes, or war seems more and more likely, more and more imminent, the state then has to consider, what will we do if the Germans cross the border, or the Poles cross the border, or the Japanese cross the border? What will we do? Well, the first thing we'll have to do is find all the people who are most likely to want to help them and kill them first, because they are the army waiting within our borders. They are the secret dangerous threat within. And that concept of the threat within, the fact that as a revolution in 1917, that the business was never quite completed, that the enemy classes, the bad kinds of people, they were never really got rid of, and those that did sort of survive somehow, they went to ground and pretended to be good socialists and pretended to be good Soviet citizens, but in reality the belief was that this wasn't the case, that they are hiding behind masks. And I've mentioned many times before, there was this obsession between from the regime about what lay behind the mask, what was happening internally in people's thinking and their conceptions of everyday reality. What were people hiding? Stalin famously says of the kulaks, essentially, that they're very good actors, that they can wear a mask sometimes that presents them as a good party citizen, but really there's an enemy lurking in there, so you've got to root them out. And the final logic, of course, to all of this is that if you shoot 100 innocent men and get one guilty one, the logic of the regime is that's basically okay. Whereas this is kind of like an anathema to Western liberal thinking. Anyway, thanks very much for listening to the podcast, and I'll catch you on the next edition. We are going to be putting out lots of new content on Patreon in the next few months, so do check us out there, and if you're able to fund the podcast, that's great. And also check out the Explaining History Facebook group. There's always something going on there. Yes, have yourselves a great day. And check out our new website, www.explaininghistory.org, where you can see the latest videos that I've posted, and also any blog content that there is. Thanks very much, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.